Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Rise About Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder and host of the Rise About Justice Movement podcast and of the movement. Today, I would like to give a brief viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing today. Today, I am joined by Katie White, who is a co-founder of Enough, based out of the UK. Katie, welcome to the Rise About Justice Movement podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me today.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the situation that, you know, across prevention and recovery based in the UK, you see a unique perspective, and also kind of looking into like what's happening in the United States and like that cross, you know, focusing on like that cross prevention aspect. What are you seeing? And just walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, of course. And I think while we're based in the UK right now, it's unfortunately a very similar picture across the world, in the US as well, in other countries. And we have an international epidemic when it comes to rape and sexual violence, and it's getting worse. And part of the reason it's getting worse is because so much of it is invisible. We haven't yet created systems of reporting that survivors overwhelmingly want to use. And until we can create that, we're going to continue to have rape and sexual violence as underground issues where they only really come to light if they affect you or someone close to you. And to put exact numbers on it, in the UK, a woman is actually twice as likely to be raped as to get cancer each year. So it's over 400,000 women is the best estimate who are raped in the UK each year. It's quite amazing how hard it is to actually find good estimates for male rape in the UK. The US has better figures and research when it comes to that. But we know that it happens to men too. We see that 5 in 6 women don't want to report, 4 in 5 men don't want to report, 9 in 10 students don't want to report. And you also see that there is no effective deterrence yet really in society. So less than 1% of rapists are convicted. And that means survivors are told a message of, well, there's no point reporting because you go through that process that can often be incredibly traumatic to try and get criminal justice. But most of the time, 99% of the time, it doesn't lead to any outcome. And it also tells perpetrators, go ahead, there's no consequences. And this isn't serious, because if it was serious, society would be taking it more seriously. So we know it's a huge problem. Society is becoming increasingly aware, but so much of it is still invisible. Our government in the UK, Labour, when they came into power, they said that they would be halving violence against women and girls, VOG, in the next decade. And they haven't yet shown any preventative initiatives that they're launching to do so. So there is very much a public expectation that real change is being delivered on this topic, and it's so necessary. It's coming too late, really, because the problem has reached such catastrophic levels. And as I say, it's very similar picture around the world. We get messages, I'll talk more about the work we're doing, but we get messages requesting that we go to pretty much every country in the world on a daily basis. And it's horrific that that is the case, but it also shows that what we've developed in this idea of building something that survivors actually want to use is so intuitive to people and really is a first step in trying to solve this problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people really focus on like the United States because, you know, we have some of the astronomical rates, but also looking at it from a global scale, it's not just the United States. And the United States, in a lot of regards, is actually advanced more than other parts of the world. And then it just kind of goes back and forth, you know? And Enough has only been around for a year, right? You launched in October 2024, correct?
Yeah, so I mean, by the time this comes out, it will probably be almost exactly a year that we launched. And you're right that in some respects, the US could be seen to be more advanced because there are alternative reporting systems that have been tried and tested in the US. And we've learned from those. We've learned from many different things in launching and developing Enough. But the very first thing that we started with was speaking to survivors because we knew that the only way we could try and stop this is if we give survivors a form of reporting that they actually want to use and is of benefit to them, because otherwise you continue to have a system and a problem where it's kept invisible. And we believe that, and not everyone agrees with this, but we believe that it's not on survivors to change to fulfill the needs of the system. We believe it's on the system and on society to provide optionality and choice to survivors and help people have something that's gonna help them in their recovery, but also stop it happening to others at the same time. So we went and did that initial research almost 2 years ago now, probably around 2 years ago, and that involved literally just putting posters up on the backs of loos and saying, "Are you a survivor and do you want to help end rape?" And through those sign-ups and through those very courageous and honest conversations, we learned a huge amount, and we learned a huge amount about why people aren't reporting today. And it's not because they don't want to report at all, it's just because the existing options feel very binary and extreme to them. So it feels to most survivors that they either have the option of do everything and decide immediately that they're gonna report and make it more official, or do nothing. And in the 48 hours, or in some cases a week, that you have to make that decision, the time flies by and you cannot be sure of what you should do. And that's one of the effects of trauma, but it's also just a reality of making a decision of that scale that's going to affect your life for years to come and your family's life or friend's life. It requires a lot more consideration than what the time currently allows. And so in those conversations, there were essentially three themes that came out that people wanted to have access to or wanted to be available to them. And that's what we've built at Enough. So the first is, people want to be able to document what's happened to them and then be able to decide later if they do anything with it. But even if they decide to do nothing with it, they've got it there, they've saved it. And that's such an essential step in recovery, is that confirmation and acknowledgement of what's happened and it not being your fault that then allows you to move forwards. The second thing is prevention and stopping this happening to other people. And then the third thing is being able to get better without depending on therapy. And so that's essentially what we have created. We've tried to give survivors those three things. And then the rest of the time pre-launch, we spent speaking to experts and getting their perspective on this as well and factoring that into the development. But all in all, Tom and I worked on it for a year, part-time, evenings, weekends, whenever we could, got the idea together. And then at the point where we could launch it, we both left our previous jobs and dedicated all of our time and energy into just making that launch happen, which was roughly a year ago today.
Which is incredible. It really is. And it's one of the most inspiring things that I've heard about in a very long time. So, first of all, congrats on 1 year, right? Because that is such a huge, 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 huge thing that is absolutely needed. And this, your organization inspires me beyond belief because it's like this revolutionary, which is something that is so incredibly needed, And I'm just in awe of the work that you are doing. And I absolutely love seeing it. I love hearing about it. And you've been a joy to sit down and like talk to. And you, Tom, and Maisie do this incredible work, and your collaborators and your social media content and your video library. Like there's so many incredible things. So what led you to creating enough, and just walk us through like that journey. You know, like you said, you were working at a previous job, and you know, you were doing it part time and on the weekends and whenever you had some free time. But what was it like? You know, what was that process of creating enough? Like, what was that? You know, did you? I'm sure it was like a 100 and a half like spreadsheets and things. So I can imagine like that process because you know, creating the movement that I have like, you know, like hundreds of tabs open. I'm doing research and I'm looking, you know, for like different collaborators and looking for organizations like yours that we can continue to collaborate with, right? But what was that journey and what led you to creating enough? Like, obviously, you saw a need for this, right? And what was that journey like for you?
Just before I come on to that, I just want to pick up on one thing you said a moment ago about disruption and how important that is, and sort of this revolutionary approach. And I couldn't agree with you more. We've really, really struggled and failed as a society to bring in new ideas in this space. And I think part of that is because of how sensitive the topic is. So of course people want to be sure we're doing the right things and everything is safe and trauma informed and is going to make a difference. But I think we've also seen that having too much risk aversion and being too scared of change for those reasons actually can create just as much harm, if not more harm, because we look at the pace of change in other sectors and we look at the new ideas that are coming up, and that just hasn't happened when it comes to sexual violence and sexual violence prevention. And there are many, many initiatives that are doing wonderful work in the space of awareness, but we do very little when it comes to new potential preventative solutions. And I'm not aware of other initiatives like enough, and I think that's wrong. I think there should be so many innovations when it comes to sexual violence prevention and support for survivors after sexual violence. And I've been to countless health conferences and health tech and femtech events through this journey, and we are always the only one that is talking about new ideas in preventing sexual violence. And there should be innovation hubs and incubation zones and things like that across the country and across the world that put this at the top of the list when it comes to priorities. So if there are people listening that have ideas or thoughts, or even if it's just at the level of a conversation with a friend about something that might work, go a bit further with it, talk further about it, because we have to have more approaches, not less, if we want to try and fix this and change the way things are happening today. And that leads me into the journey, because this me and Tom meeting could have so easily not have happened, and I could be so easily not sitting here right now and talking to you, and I'm so glad we are. But Tom is the father of one of my friends, and he lives in New York. I was living in San Francisco a few years ago for work, and we happened to meet, and we happened to have a conversation about sexual violence. And this was just in one evening, and it became very clear that both of us were very committed to doing something about it. And he has dedicated the last 8 years of his career to learning about this space, particularly like the mental health side of things, as well as prevention. He set up Talk Consent, which is the UK's fastest growing consent education company, alongside his son, Dan. And we just had this remarkable evening and conversation, and we kept that conversation going, and it led from a conversation to ideas, to meeting with experts, having those research conversations with survivors. And of course, there was a huge amount of sacrifice involved, because you can't just work on something on top of a full-time job and it have no effect on your life. But I mean, I can't speak for Tom, but I feel like we would both say that it's so worth it, and it's not something that we've ever questioned or thought, was that the right thing to do? And I think sometimes when people have ideas, they actually think, you know what, I should quit everything right now and just go for it. And that's not always the best thing, because sometimes when you're starting something new, having the constraint of only having a few hours a week to work on it means you really do focus on the most important stuff. And I think that's a lesson that we've carried through to now, even though we're both working on it full time, we really do just have a focus on the things that matter. And yes, we saw less of our friends, and yes, we made a huge financial sacrifice as well. And for me, that involved not renting anywhere for a year and kind of sofa surfing between my boyfriends and my family and various friends, so that that money I could put towards having an effective salary the next year, because I saved it and didn't spend it. And Tom has a similar situation as well, similar sacrifices. But I'm so glad I made and we made those sacrifices. And yes, it's a heavy topic, and people often ask if that gets too much, but that's pretty low down in terms of the problems and difficulties that I encounter or we encounter. And I think it's because we do take such an empowering take on the problem as well. We're not just talking about it, we're doing something. And for me, even if we stop this happening to just one person every single hour that we've spent working on it, or every single sacrifice, or every single evening where I've been crying for whatever reason, it's all worth it. And I wouldn't question it for a moment. And partway along that journey, we met Dr. Maisie, who's our clinical lead, and it's just phenomenal at what she does. She's both a private therapist, she works for the NHS, and she also supports us at Enough. And she believes that there has to be a place for more accessible, digital, free recovery resources, as well as a place for sort of the luxury of therapy. And you can call it a luxury because it is expensive, or it involves waiting a significant amount of time to be able to access it. And so together we've built recovery resources that build from core principles like the ecosystems theory, where we're supporting at every level of someone's context and journey, whether that's their set themselves or friends or family or wider societal context as well. And it was just so refreshing to meet Maisie and to have worked with Maisie for this time, pretty much for the full 2 years as well. Because while on one hand we want to stop this happening in the first place, we also do need to acknowledge that it is still happening right now to people across the world. And it's something that happened to many people, to people many years ago, and they deserve effective recovery and helpful validating messages. So that's what we're trying to deliver, as much as we're trying to stop it in the first place. And I think one of the highlights of this whole journey is the people that we meet along the way, and those posters that I mentioned that we put on the backs of loos to do the research. Many of those people ended up becoming ambassadors in our first launch city in Bristol. And I've never met people before by putting posters in loos. And it's such a wonderful values-led way of meeting like-minded people. And I recommend it to anyone who's trying to form a group or hire new people, is put posters on the backs of loos, because you remove any type of bias and you do just find people who align. So yeah, that's kind of a snapshot of the journey, and there's much more to it, but it's been quick, it's been impactful at a very early stage, and I think that's why so many people are so interested in the concepts that we've developed.
Exactly. And that leads into the next, question that I, or next aspect that I wanted to talk about was that impact that Enough has had up to this point. You're impacting people all across the country, all across the world, actually. I remember whenever Enough Recovery followed us on Instagram, and I was like, okay, who? I was thinking like, okay, who is this, right? And it led me on to going to your website, which looks incredible, by the way. The new website looks absolutely phenomenal.
Oh,
Like,
thank you.
it looks absolutely incredible. I know it just launched, and it looks absolutely incredible. Not that the previous one was horrible by any stretch, but this one looks absolutely incredible. It's so easy to find, so easy to navigate, and it walks through the entire process and everything that you all are creating. It is beyond incredible. To say that I fangirl is an understatement, but it's so well put together. And you can tell that you, Tom, and Dr. Maisie, like, you can tell that you take so much care, and it's so carefully put together and so much thought, and the processes behind it is just phenomenal. So, kudos to you, obviously. But what impact is Enough having? What are people saying? What are people, I see comments on your social media, and they're praising everything y'all are doing because it's raising awareness about these issues, but it's not just saying we have an issue. No, this is actually going further, finding those solutions. And you said it best earlier, whenever you said we need to have these incubator conversations and continue to bring people together, because this isn't just one issue and one issue alone. There's so much intersections to it. Domestic violence, sexual assault, trafficking, it all ties together. Sexual and gender-based violence is a complex issue. It's not just a one singular issue. This goes across multiple, aspects of it, but it also comes from generational trauma. And it comes from these, living in poverty and gun violence and, seeing, oh God, there's so many aspects that go into it. But what has been that impact like up to this point? Because obviously there's a lot more that you're going to continue doing. But what does it look like up to this point right now, that impact?
And would it be helpful if I summarize quickly exactly what Enough is as well? Because I don't think for people who haven't heard of us before. So I talked about the things that survivors asked for in the research being a place to save what's happened securely and come back to it if you want, a way of preventing it happening to other people, and then getting better without depending on therapy. And what we've developed is an encrypted portal where if someone has been raped or sexually assaulted, they can go into that portal. It's secure, it's encrypted. They can write down, they create an account, write down what's happened to them. There's two portals. One allows you to write it down and no one else sees. The other, it's made really clear if you want to share an anonymous part of your testimony on social media via Enough, you can write in a line or two, and then we broadcast those on social media. And it's a way of one, creating deterrence because those are seen by tens of thousands of people each week. On average, we have about 1 million social media views across our platforms each week, almost 50-50 male and female views. And the other part of it is that it just gives people a voice too, because it can be so hard to have that voice and to speak up without having the risk that it's going to define you. And that's why so many people do stay silent. So we try and give people that outlet. And then the other part of the portal is that it allows you to use a self-testing DNA kit. And you self-swab, you write down your barcode number, you put it in the free post returns envelope, and then you get two types of results, really. The first is that you are told the number and gender of DNA profiles found in or on you. And the other part of the results is half of the DNA is frozen untested. And that's so that if the police want to use the DNA because you've reported to them and you want to pass it over, then they can request the barcode number and that frozen untested DNA is handed over to them. And that DNA can be admissible. We make it really clear that for anyone who wants to go to the police immediately, they should do that first. That's the better forensic examination. But In the UK, the stats are only 1 in 18 survivors are going to the police soon enough to even have the possibility of a forensic evidence collection. So we've got 17 out of 18 people who right now have nothing because they don't feel comfortable going in the time frame that they've got. But the wider purpose, and sorry, just one more thing to mention on that is that anyone can make a testimony, can submit testimony. You can do that from the US. You can do that if it happened 10 years ago, 50 years ago. You can do it if it happened last week. It's the DNA kit, which is for right now, but anyone can submit that written piece and save it in a portal online. And then the broader purpose of the kit is to stop it happening in the first place. If in a university, and I give a university as an example because you have a closed effect within a campus where students talk, everyone knows about everything, that's kind of word of mouth is particularly powerful there, as well as social media. If students know that self-testing DNA kits are available, it creates a threat and accountability that didn't exist before. So we gave out 8,000 kits in Bristol last year, and that's a university of 30,000 students. That meant that one in every three or four students had one of these. And that meant that every friendship group, every uni flat or house definitely knew about the kits if they didn't have one. And so we've heard from students that they believe that created 70% prevention of sexual violence on campus. The main reason being, they say it started conversations that were previously silenced. And before then, the only conversations about sexual violence and consent that were happening were after the fact. So if it happened to someone in a friendship group and they were talking about the impact of that, or sadly, did they believe that it had even happened? Whereas now, because of these kits, they were talking about, well, why do we need these kits to exist? Oh, it's because we have a huge problem on campus and people don't feel comfortable reporting. And why do we have these kits? Because people don't want to report to the police or the university, so this gives them power and another option. And ultimately, if you didn't support enough, it raised questions of, well, why don't you support enough? What does that say about you? And we witnessed the most amazing effect among young men, where young male students who previously it's been really hard for them to know what to say on this topic without potentially being cancelled or, say the wrong thing and you're branded as like toxic masculinity. So it was really quite inspiring to witness them see an opportunity to be allies and affect social change and then really take that opportunity. The rugby club, which is the group probably most associated with, stereotypical dominating masculine behaviors, unfairly so, was the first group to say we want to dedicate a match to survivors and talk about how much we support enough. We've run campaigns with dads where we educate dads on the difference they can make and how they need to step up and have this conversation and not kind of bury their heads in the sand. So the social deterrence is only possible with that male allyship and with that involvement from all people, not just the people that it's more likely to happen to. And that figure of 70%, when you compare it to the less than 1% conviction rate of perpetrators, it really does make you stop and think and wonder, could this be like smoking or could this be like drink driving where public health campaigns and social deterrence were the main drivers of behavior change, not just criminal deterrence. And then the last part of Enough, which is hugely important and is what we've been working on with Dr. Maisie, is the recovery. And it's been proven by the NHS that it can be just as effective to watch a video with a therapist as to go and have therapy. And that's a huge finding in terms of democratizing recovery after sexual violence. 75% of trauma sufferers across any type of trauma will never access therapy, and they deserve support. They deserve better than nothing. And so we've built off that NHS research. We've built from the ecosystems theory that I mentioned, and polyvagal theory as well, which was a huge part of Dr. Maisie's research in her master's, sorry, in her doctorate. And so much of that is based on having choice, having autonomy, and being able to understand why we think certain things and why we reacted in certain ways and why we feel the way we do, to be able to then acknowledge and have that level of acceptance, and then move forwards and move on with your life, and not be affected to the same extent when it comes to trauma. And right now, 94%, this is in the UK, but the statistics are similar across the world. 94% of survivors are suffering symptoms of PTSD in the first 2 weeks. That's almost everyone. And 50% develop full-blown PTSD after 6 months. And that is preventable. There are people there who do not need to be experiencing PTSD. But for that to be the case, there has to be immediate or early intervention. And that's just not happening right now because of the waiting list for therapy, or because people decide they don't want to have therapy because it can feel like such a big deal to sit in a room and unburden all of that when you're not even sure that you can think through it clearly yourself, let alone explain it to someone else. So we've created a digital recovery channel on Instagram and TikTok and YouTube where survivors can come on, and they can, and also friends and family and allies can come on as well and watch this content. And it just helps them understand what's happened, why it happened, as in why their body reacted in the way it did, and even through to reclaiming your sexuality and why that can be quite hard. We're really trying to get more diverse voices on there as well. Our vision is that it's a place where any survivor, any person could come to and see someone that they can relate to and learn from. And it's wonderful that you're considering coming on as well, Zachary, and featuring on our recovery podcast. So in essence, across the reporting, the deterrence, the recovery, we're trying to replace inaction. We're not trying to replace anything that exists today. We're trying to give people who right now feel alone and who on the whole are alone, we're trying to give them acknowledgement, validation, support, and we're trying to educate a generation that have been raised on porn being a large part of their sex education. We're trying to educate them that actually consent is what matters. Consent is the cool thing, rather than sex being the cool thing.
Exactly. And you hit on a lot of very important parts. And the next aspect that I want to talk about is like the male allyship and the importance of their role. Because in the world of Jeffrey Epstein's and Harvey Weinstein, and even this going as far as like Marilyn Manson, right? Like there's so many different like quote unquote like male role models that a lot of people look up to, right? So in a world filled, like I said, with people like Jeffrey Epstein, because it's not just the United States that, he was directly involved in. It goes across the world, right? Why is it important for male allyship to recognize their role in the, ending sexual and gender-based violence?
Many people don't realize the power that they can have as individuals. And I think if people did realize the power they could have, especially collective power, we'd see more people step forward and just make quite small changes in their lives. For example, on Instagram, liking something, commenting on something, sharing something, following something, you're helping contribute towards a less toxic, more positive culture. All too often, there's conversations about things we should be removing from social media and things we should be banning. And yes, I agree. And we agree that there's lots of stuff that needs to come down and that shouldn't be influencing young men, especially. But we also need to fill that hole with something, and we need to fill that hole with something that is engaging and appealing, because otherwise, like, social media companies are not going to bother with it. And that's part of the reason why they're not as quick to take things down as we'd hope, is because sadly those content pieces drive views for them. So there are small individual things that users can do, and even down to the new Instagram feature where you can repost something, and all it does is it pushes that positive piece of content to your followers, but still from the same account. So anyone can go onto our Instagram on Enough to End Rape or Enough Recovery and hit that little, looks like a recycling button. And it just means that your viewers see that post from us, sorry, your followers see that post from us as well. And so there's lots of sort of micro ways that people can help contribute to a greater social change. And then I think on a more of an idle level, we do just need to champion the men that are doing good work, and we need young boys to look up to them rather than looking up to the toxic men. And dads play a huge part in that too, and that's why we have started this Dads for Daughters campaign, where dads and parents can just be really scared of knowing what to say, if anything, and they can be scared that they say, "My daughter's only 12 years old. How do I know what to say?" And it's, if you're not saying something to her, then someone else probably is, and it's probably not accurate. And with young people, the first thing that they hear is what they tend to hold as accurate, and everything else either confirms that view or is misinformed, is the way that they process it. It's a type of confirmation bias, essentially. So we do need to be getting in there and having those conversations. And through our work, we've seen that boys want to, but, and I'm talking about boys, but it's girls as well. Like, young people just, they want to fit in, they want to belong, and so they go along with what they think everyone else believes or what everyone else respects or admires. And all too often, it's something that actually no one respects or admires, but everyone thinks everyone else does, so they just go along with it. And so we need to give young people the confidence, but we also need to give them the idols and the allies that are actually positive to look up to. And I think we've been effective in that so far, given that so many of our viewers and followers are men. We don't want this to just be a girls v boys thing and have this army of female followers and not bring men into the conversation. We're really proud of the fact that our viewers are almost 50-50 across gender. And I think it's also in part due to how gender inclusive our work is, and the kits are for any gender. It's not restricted to just one. So yeah, I think there's still a long way to go, as many other people will say on that front, but we have to play the algorithm with the good stuff. We can't just leave it that the bad stuff is playing it.
Yep, exactly. I was just about to mention about the algorithm and how it can be a little tricky to kind of like reach those people that we really want to reach, especially in like the age of like digital censorship and like shadow banning. So
Yeah.
obviously reaching some of those key players in prevention can be a little tricky. And what have been some of the highlights and disappointments of the journey that you've had so far? And I know there's been some controversy too, but what has been some of those highlights and some of those disappointments? So the highs and lows. Let's start with the lows and then we'll go into the highs. So it's
Yeah,
like,
I
so
guess
it's,
because I've spoken more about the highs as well, so
yeah.
I was going to suggest the same. Yeah, the lows have been interesting to me because they haven't been the things that I expected. I expected that when you come up with an idea in a space that is in such desperate need of change and says it needs change as sexual violence and sexual violence prevention. I thought that it would be more of a case of everyone helping out to help improve and make it better. But it's really, I guess it saddened me to see that some people or groups would prefer to make assumptions and form misconceptions and sort of perpetuate misconceptions as opposed to just have a meeting and hearing things firsthand and learning for themselves. It's disappointing to see how political it can be sometimes. And I completely respect that there's a certain level of, we need to be cautious of new things because this is so sensitive. But I think you can also be cautious while making sure you're fully informed. And I would have loved the opportunity to meet with some of the people that don't fully get what we're doing. And you spoke about controversy. There's been controversy about the kit. Some people believe that the only way people should be able to gather evidence is via the police, and that everyone should go to the police or go to a sexual assault centre, which you have in the US as well. But survivors are telling us they want something else. I mean, the numbers speak for themselves, the fact that people aren't reporting. So I think you can hold a few truths at the same time. You can hold the truth that survivors should go to the police or a sexual assault centre first. But if they don't want to, they deserve better than nothing. And I think that's where we come up against difficulties and confusion is among groups who don't understand that we always signpost people to the police or to a SARC first. It's literally impossible to make a report to enough without seeing messages of go to the police first if you'd like to. It's written on the kit about going and seeing all your various options. It's one of our first posts on social media is, it's just happened, one of the options available to me. Enough is the last one on that. So I think there's a knowledge gap there in terms of hierarchy when people sort of misunderstand the kit. And then there also has been debate about the admissibility, and we've had it confirmed now that it is admissible and it can be admissible in court. But we didn't have that written confirmation from a senior lawyer when we launched, and so that led to a bit of debate there. We had that confirmation from legal sources before we launched. We wouldn't have launched without it. But I think a learning for me is that we should have had it formally in writing on the website at the moment that we launched, because some people do like to say, this evidence won't be admissible, but it can be, and it doesn't take a lawyer to recognize if a survivor is entering into a court case that they're better off having something rather than nothing. And our main problem in the UK when it comes to criminal deterrence and criminal justice is actually not convictions when cases are in court, it's getting the cases to court. And often they don't get to court because they don't have enough evidence. So the DNA can support with that, and the timestamp testimony that effectively serves as a witness statement. Because the most common line of attack in a courtroom is from the defense saying, well, you're making this up in hindsight because you didn't do anything about it at the time. Whereas if you can point to that testimony and say, I did, I've had it saved for 10 years, and now I'm ready to go through this process, then that adds conviction to their case. So I think I try and see it all as positively as I can and think it's opportunities to learn and improve our communication. But I do just wish that, I do just wish that alongside these statements and kind of cries for radical change coming from the government and the sector, that it was matched with the same interest and openness and willingness to learn as that might suggest. And it's that's not speaking of every organization and every person in the space. It's definitely a minority, but it's made things harder than they would have been otherwise. And the only people that affects ultimately is survivors. The only group that criticism and controversy really helps is perpetrators who think, oh, well, we've got all these groups that have the same objective fighting against each other, and that's continuing to make it easier for us. But I guess somewhat expected in any type of change or revolution is that it's never going to be completely smooth sailing, and you can't have disruptive solutions to a problem without there being some level of disruption. But we're just trying to go about it in the most transparent and kind of respectful way we can, and meet with people wherever possible.
As best as possible, right? Because that can sometimes be damn near an absolute challenge. And what about some more of like the highs, like what about, just looking at your social media, it's continuing to grow, you're doing some more outreach like across the world and starting to kind of like trickle into the United States too, which I'm really excited about. And we'll kind of get into that here in just a minute about like the future plans for Enough. But what about some more of like those highs with the lo along that journey? Because wherever there's lows, there's always a positive too. And
Oh, for sure.
if there's anything that I realized about your team, it's turning those lows into highs and overcoming that, because it shows, like the data doesn't lie, right? The data shows itself, and like the survivors that you've interviewed, survivors that have contributed to like your research, you obviously know that there's a great need. And seeing that, what have been some of those highs? You talked a little bit about it like a little bit earlier, but branching off of that, what are some more like those high moments? Because there's been a lot. Like I said, you've been around for a year, so obviously what you're doing is working and it's going to continue growing. And what have been some of those high moments for you?
There's been so many. It really, really has been a wonderful journey, and it feels a bit like, when you're younger and you start to get post, and it's just the most exciting feeling ever because you don't know what's coming through the letterbox, and it's always a surprise. It very much feels like that. We have such brilliant things happen each week, from like messages we receive through to being nominated for awards and being featured on various podcasts and news channels. It's also just for me sort of the everyday moments as well, and the people that we've met and are working with on this that we could have so easily have never have met. And I think that's such a privilege and joy. And one group in particular that I love meeting with, every month we have a co-creation panel, and that's where we take a different element of what we're doing to a group of people with lived experience, and we ask their feedback, and their reflections are just, it's so insightful and helps improve the service that we're providing for other people. We've got a we've had a f a huge past couple of weeks, which has meant we're very close to announcing our next pilot city in the UK, and that's where we'll be running a formal evaluation for 3 years. And that's going to be a huge step for us, and sort of the last few weeks in getting ready for that have been just one massive highlight. As well as someone who, it's always the people that you meet that lead to the really interesting things, I find. And I met someone called Pete almost 2 years ago at a conference, like right at the start of this. And we've kept in touch, and he called me a few months ago and said, I want to host my birthday party in support of Enough. It's going to be a fundraiser. And through that night, we raised close to £10,000 just from people's donations. And him saying, I don't want a birthday present. I want you to support this organization that I really believe in. So You never know what's next, but there's always so many incredible moments like that. And you're right, we do take any of the bad things that happen as opportunities to learn and improve. And I think it will make the overall story more interesting too. I mean, no one likes a plot line where it's all smooth sailing. I think we will look back and think, how was there ever a world where we didn't have that availability of choice to survivors? And something that is a new idea now, and people are kind of coming to terms with and learning about and understanding and going through the process that you've gone through and learning about enough, it will feel so intuitive and obvious looking back that this was always going to happen at some point. But that doesn't mean it's necessarily easy and clear at the time for everyone. So I just look forward to that moment. I have such strong belief that this is going to create incredible change, not just on a national level in the UK, but also across the world. And every single time I meet a random member of the public and I talk to them about what I'm doing, including a builder that I met on the street a couple of weeks ago, their reactions are always just, "That is incredible. How did that not exist already?" And you can't be doing something that gets that good a immediate response from people and be on the wrong track. And I think for as long as we stay informed by what survivors are asking for, we will be doing the right thing. And a lot of it is just about perseverance and keeping going. But I've got the energy for that. So has the whole team. So has Tom. So has Maisie. So has all the ambassadors. And I think we're all just very excited for what's ahead.
And I'm excited too. From my perspective over here in the United States, I'm deeply excited to continue seeing what the work that you all are doing. I mean, it is so incredibly inspiring. And whenever I think of the work that you're doing, I think of an organization here in the United States called Project Callisto.
Yes,
And
we know Callisto.
yes, they are doing some very impactful work and some incredible work. And whenever you were talking about like your vault, I was thinking about that and I was like, come to think about it, there really is only two organizations that I can think of on the top of my head, and that's Enough and Callisto. That's literally it. That's doing this, work, especially like digitally, right?
Yeah.
And learning about that, because we have these tools at our hands. We have media, we have social media, we have like technology that can really help advance a lot of the work that we're doing, right? And in the world of AI, what have you saw as far as like, here in the United States, we have like a deep fake issue, like the deep fake nudity and
Yeah, we
like
have
the
the same.
videos that are being created on Google AI. And most recently, there was a thing that came to fruition and came to focus that somebody was going into Google AI and uploading videos to YouTube about how to murder women. And that's deeply devastating to learn about. And, this is something that's going on. And in the minds of people, it makes you wonder what's to come, right? So, what are you noticing in the world of like AI based in the UK? What are you noticing?
Well, and tell me if this is kind of changing the question and I can come back to what you're asking. But when we think about AI right now, we're focusing on the good stuff it can do, because that's what we can control. So we're working right now on kind of taking the power of AI and combining it with digital therapy and the work we're already doing in recovery to create a platform which will help people genuinely prevent the onset of PTSD. Right now, we're creating resources that we believe are helping people, but there's no sort of built-in assessment and program to it. So, and you have to be doing something continuously for it to have sustained impact. So, we're quite excited about the potential of AI in the recovery space, and it's something that hasn't been tried with sexual violence recovery to date. But in terms of the negatives, I mean, of course, it's inherent in something that is growing faster than the regulation concerning it is growing. And we all know that the people that are in the positions of power and could slow the advancement of AI and make sure that some of the dangers and pitfalls are avoided aren't doing so on the whole. But the problems that you talk about, we have exactly the same problems in the UK. And I think the best thing that we can do for now is people can continue to speak up about cases where it's affecting them, and then we can use that to lobby change in Parliament. And we see that with quite a lot of reality TV stars in the UK go on to use their platform for good and speak about issues like deepfakes and then turn that into petitions and roundtables in Parliament and get change actually made in the law. So I think we should all continue to support individuals like that are making that change happen, because laws only change when there's enough pressure for that change to come about. But yeah, it in equal parts excites and terrifies me. But I think there need to be more organizations focusing on using the positives of it to help people.
Yeah, I absolutely love hearing about the positive aspects of it because it kind of, it switches that focus, like, yes, we recognize that these issues are going on, but here's the positives and let's drown out that negative with something positive. So I love doing that. And I think that's a crucial aspect of it. And I'm glad you touched on like therapy aspects of it and, different things like that. I'm really glad you touched on that. So you mentioned about doing another pilot city. Outside of that, what also is some more future plans for it enough that you can obviously discuss about? What can you see happening in like the next year, 2 years, 3 years, and onward?
Yeah, well, what we're already seeing is international requests from people who want to bring enough to their country. And so we're having conversations with people about how we might be able to set that up and work with them. And enough is something that does need to be available across the world. We're starting with the UK, but we're very interested in taking it to other countries. We think it should be available in pharmacies, like the equivalent of CVS for us is Boots, should be available via your DoorDashes and Deliveroos and Uber Eats. And it's only when it becomes a household name and something that is spoken about, and college kids, university kids are going off to university with one, that we will achieve the level of social deterrence that we witnessed in Bristol happening on a national level and then international. And so that's our focus for the future. The things that are helping with that and that are exciting that we've got in the pipeline is we're getting increasing government support in the UK, and we'll be having an important meeting with a lot of MPs in the next couple of months in the UK. We're getting advised by very senior people in public prosecutions and the Home Office. And so all of those relationships are helping us achieve that change faster. I think also just continuing to grow the platform of enough so that we're able to help more and more people, because even someone who is listening to this or comes across enough in the US, they can still benefit from all of the ways where you can submit a testimony and all of the recovery videos and all of the social content and education that is all available to them. And so I'm excited just to continue developing really strong social content and educational resources that mean more people can have more conversations with their friends because they can look at something we've done and then say to their friends, oh, did you know? Actually, the most common response after sexual violence is to freeze. And the most common thing is for that to start 3, 4 minutes before the rape occurs because your body is preparing for the fact it's about to happen. So by giving people helpful pieces of knowledge, it then has a butterfly effect into their friendship groups and social circles. So that is a harder, it's a less tangible thing, but it's something that is well, how we got to this conversation today really is you coming across the content. So a mix of really ambitious things and also the steps that we're taking to getting there. And then I did mention the upcoming launch in another city in the UK. And I think that will really help with some of the misconceptions that I mentioned too, because we will be able to say, you know, every concern or possible risk is valid, and we are going to be mitigating it and minimizing it in this formal evaluation. But we will also be able to see how real and how prevalent that perceived issue is, and then we will be able to create changes if it is there. But otherwise, we're just sort of debating things that we don't know whether they're the case or not. So I'm looking forward to having that tangibility and sort of independent assessment that's going to come from a formal evaluation.
I'm so excited to continue, the collaborative pieces with, Rise Above Justice Movement and, Enough and just some of the other organizations. We collaborate a lot with Callisto, like we mentioned earlier, too. And I'll be interviewing the executive director, Tracy, on a future podcast episode very soon. And deeply excited, to continue the deep collaborative efforts and, looking forward to seeing future content, more collaborations. And there's so much work to do. We have
Yeah.
such a deeply impactful work that we can do in this digital space, and we can continue advocating in different ways, right?
Yeah.
So, is there anything else that you'd like to share about Enough or about your own personal journey or anything for the listeners today?
Just give me a moment. I think I would just encourage people to be bold and to say the thing that they want to say, but maybe have been too scared to say before, because you will likely not be the only person who is feeling that way or feeling uncomfortable about something that's been said. And the longer we bury our heads in the sand or don't speak up, the more we perpetuate the behavior, which is just making things worse. So I think have that bravery, be the person that others respect and admire, and don't let the sort of herd mentality and wanting to fit in stop you from doing what's right. Because really the group that you want to respect you is the group that are the good people, not the group that are going to stay silent when there's social injustice. And there is always something you can do, whether it's just supporting an account on social media or having conversations or organizing fundraisers. Every single one of us can make a difference. And if you feel inspired by any of this and want to either help out Enough or help out another organization, just message us or message any other organization, because we're all doing this on a shoestring. There's no real funding at the moment for this type of idea, and that's something that's hopefully going to change for us quite soon. But it's just to say, you know, any offer of help is always appreciated, because often nonprofits don't have the resources that others have.
Yeah, absolutely. And you hit a key part on that. A lot of the federal grants here in the United States have been ended, like a lot of the VAWA. So Violence Against Women Act funds have been
Yeah.
ended, and they're not going to direct service providers. And also, the defense secretary has removed protections for victims of crime within the military. That's deeply devastating to think about. And I think about Vanessa Guillen, who was murdered on a military base here in the United States. I think about that and how many others potentially could come after that. So we have a deep issue, and we need people to recognize the issues and get involved. And you said it best, message an organizer, message an organization, message an advocate or a leader within our communities, get involved. It doesn't always have to be, going to protests. It doesn't always have to be, fundraising money. Like, just simply sharing that content can really help. And, watching videos, education is a big key role in prevention, but also the postvention after sexual assault, after violence. And again, I want to say thank you for coming onto the podcast today and, sharing your wisdom and sharing your future for and how people can get involved in ending sexual and gender-based violence, especially with the digital spaces. I think it's incredibly crucial, but also just getting out into the community too. So again, Katie, thank you so much for the work that you do. I am so excited, to continue collaborating with Enough and continue to see the growth. And I admire the work that you're doing very deeply. It means the entire world to me. And I know it will mean a lot to for future generations to look back on, see, going from a negative to a positive and turning the rage into action and the action into policy and the policy into implementation to help survivors, get through their healing journey, because healing is not linear. It's very complex. And what may have worked for me may not work for the next person, but I think finding that common space and finding those new self-care techniques, I think, is actually absolutely incredible. So,
Thank you. And I think the thing that Maisie would want to share sort of as a final note for everyone is a lot of the people listening to this are probably people who have had experiences themselves or know people who have and so therefore care deeply. And we've built our recovery channel to give people answers on topics that can feel confusing or lonely. And so if you or if someone you love has been affected by this, go on the recovery channel and write into us and say the sort of things that you would like explainers on, and we will do our best to create those. So see this as a direct way of getting of asking questions to a therapist and getting that clinical response. And we just want to make sure that we're creating stuff that is helpful to people.
Absolutely. Continue doing the incredible work that you're doing, and we will continue to amplify. We'll continue to collaborate. And with that, again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. You take care of yourself, and we will speak
Thank
with
you.
you very soon.
Yeah, thank you. You too. Bye.
Thank you.